It is Monday, January 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a car bomb in Idlib, Syria kills 23 people. What world role exists for Britain following Brexit? And recent sex scandals dominate the Golden Globe Awards. It's all ahead. Syrian forces, backed by allied militia and Russian airstrikes, have launched an offensive into the last large rebel stronghold, Idlib province in the northwest, dominated by al-Qaeda-linked militants. It comes after the defeat of organized Islamic State resistance. At least 23 people, some of them civilians, were killed by a car bomb in Idlib Sunday. However, it's unclear what the objective is. It's uncertain if the Syrian commander intends to engage in a potentially long and costly battle for control of the province and run the risk of sparking another refugee exodus. Sunday, his forces captured the town of Sinjar. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said dozens of villages have been taken from rebel forces in Idlib in the past 2 weeks. Anthony Billingsley, a Middle East lecturer at the University of New South Wales, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, capture of most of the province would be another great victory for President Bashar al-Assad.
Assad would be wanting to regain control of as much of the country as he possibly can, and so this is a logical step. It secures his control over access to Aleppo. It also presents a bit of a challenge to the Turks, who have been demonstrating quite a bit of interest in dominating the northern part of Syria for their own interests. So there's a lot of reasons why they would do that.
There apparently are a lot of risks carried with this offensive. The province is home to more than 2.5 million people, including more than 1 million who fled fighting elsewhere in the country. A full-blown government offensive could cause large-scale destruction and massive displacement, the last thing that region needs.
And certainly the last thing the people need, but I don't think the government will be, or the Russians will be concerned by that. Their objective is to regain the territory, and as we've seen elsewhere in the country during the fighting, the government hasn't felt concerned to avoid civilian casualties or at least the movement of refugees.
A lot of rebels have fled there from other regions of the country. This certainly would be a tremendously bloody affair.
In a lot of cases, we've had deals between the government and opposition forces where the opposition would pull out of a particular town and the forces would move with their families towards places like Idlib. And so you have this growing concentration of, and as you say, often very battle-hardened and skilled fighters. And we can see that this has been going on, as with Ghouta, close to Damascus. This has been going on for almost the length of the war, and the government hasn't been able to overtake them yet. But I think that, you know, what we'll see is probably a similar pattern to what we've seen elsewhere with Russian bombing and barrel bombs from the Syrians and that sort of thing as a way of softening the place up.
If the province's entire capture is not the main objective, could it possibly be securing the main Damascus to Aleppo road? How serious and how significant is that?
Well, I think it's very significant. The whole idea of controlling the spine, if you like, of Syria, it's almost a topographical spine as well, running down through Aleppo and Homs and Hama down to Damascus is very important to the government. And the opposition has been able to break that a few times, but they're intent on, I think, consolidating government control of that line.
If Idlib province, which is rebel-dominated right now, is reduced or contained, what does this do to the overall strategy in this conflict?
The government may just decide, you know, okay, we've got them bottled up in this little corner in the northwest of the country, we'll just leave them. But the problem for that is that outside forces, the US and Turkey in particular, have been supplying the rebels in the area, which would always give them the opportunity ultimately to strike back at the government. So I think the government's going to be a bit concerned that it doesn't want to leave itself vulnerable to constant, maybe pindrick, but constant attacks by opposition forces.
That's Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales. The observatory said nearly 150 civilians, militants, and government force members have been killed since the offensive was launched, on December 25th. Time now for social media. Well, the U.S. announced Monday that it's ending a 17-year temporary residency status for 200,000 Salvadorans, leaving them vulnerable to deportation in 18 months if they cannot secure legal residency in the U.S. The Salvadorans have lived in the U.S. since 2001, when two devastating earthquakes disrupted life in El Salvador. They were granted temporary protected status, TPS, to live in the U.S., a provision that until now had been routinely renewed with little debate in Washington. But the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has taken a harder line on immigration controls and in the last year had already ended the protected status for 59,000 Haitians and 5,300 Nicaraguans under the same program affecting the Salvadorans. On Twitter, hashtag 200,000 Salvadorans is trending. Ed Krasenstein tweets, "Breaking with Trump kicking 200,000 Salvadorans from this country. Let's not forget that these individuals have had 190,000 plus children in the 17 years they've been here. Trump is essentially separating these children from their parents. This is un-American and inhumane." But Pete tweets, 200,000 Salvadorans question, what do you call 200,000 Salvadorans having to be deported because they're here illegally? Answer, a good start. Well, today is January 8th, and it would have been the 71st birthday of singer David Bowie. His widow, the model Iman, tweeted a childhood picture of him and posted 1947 forever, hashtag forever Bowie. It's also the birth anniversary of rock and roll king Elvis Presley. Music History tweets, hashtag Elvis Presley was born on this day, 8th January 1935, in Tupelo, Mississippi, U.S. Singer, musician, and actor. Died the 16th of August, 1977, in Memphis, Tennessee, U.S., age 42. Lemon Beats tweets, Elvis Presley would have turned 83 today. Often referred to as the king, hashtag Elvish, hashtag Elvis Presley, hashtag Elvis birthday. And that is a look at social media. Here are some of the top news stories trending. 64 people are feared dead as a trafficking boat sinks in the Mediterranean. Egypt sets a March date for presidential elections. Jordan state media says intelligence foiled a massive Islamic State plot, and a new report warns Islamic State is increasing its footprint in Pakistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Are you someone who performs random acts of kindness for other people? A person walking in front of you drops a bag of groceries and its contents spill out everywhere. You instinctively stoop down and help the other gather up the dropped items. It's just a natural human impulse. New research from Duke University now suggests that we're not the only species that displays such altruistic behavior. It turns out bonobos, a group of primates from Africa's Congo Basin, will go out of their way to help strangers without being asked to do so. While studying bonobos who were born in the wild, the researchers found that the small apes will help another get food even when their efforts aren't reciprocated. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at the very cold weather here in North America. As Britain's 2019 exit from the European Union edges closer, it's looking to carve out a new role for itself on the world stage. Many analysts say it could struggle to retain its influence as other world powers demand greater representation in global bodies like the United Nations. But as Henry Ridgewell reports from London, the British government insists it's looking to build global alliances beyond Europe.
Britain punches above its weight, a boxing analogy once used by a former foreign secretary to describe his country's role on the world stage, and often repeated since. But the punch could be losing power, says Luke McDonough of City University London.
Leaving the EU means that the UK could now be seen as a medium-sized economy in an increasingly polarised world where there are massive economic blocs. You have the United States, you have China, you have the EU. In the coming century, you'll also have India, the rise of South America and Africa to compete as well. What will the UK's place be?
McDonough says a measure of Britain's fading clout was its November loss of a judge at the International Court of Justice. After a long battle at the United Nations, London withdrew its candidate, allowing an Indian judge to take the place occupied by Britain since the ICJ's inception in 1946.
The way the powers game works now is decidedly different from that of 1945. And we have to question whether the UN Security Council will continue in this form for much longer.
But it is unlikely Britain will lose its permanent seat on the UN Security Council anytime soon, says UN expert Richard Gowan of the European Council on Foreign Relations.
Most of the big powers in the Security Council, including the United States and China, don't want to see any serious reforms to the institution in the foreseeable future.
Britain insists it is not turning inward. The government's post-Brexit ambition is to create what it terms a global Britain.
On the one hand, the British Foreign Service will be able to invest more resources in UN affairs now that they are going to be less focused on the EU. But on the other hand, without the support of 27 other countries, the British are going to find it much harder to influence debates over humanitarian affairs, development or security through the UN.
A foretaste came in June when many EU countries failed to vote with Britain on its claim to the Chagos Islands in the Indian Ocean. Britain needs to keep Europe on side, argues Gowan.
If the British are seen to be simply cozying up to the Americans, they are going to lose a lot of goodwill from their European partners pretty quickly.
In seeking a new role on the world stage, analysts say Britain will need to forge new alliances while keeping old friends close and try to weather turmoil back home. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
A life-threatening cold front swept across North America, bringing piles of snow and icy conditions. The National Weather Service issued wind chill advisories and freeze warnings covering a vast area from South Texas to Canada and from Montana through New England. VOA's Carol Pearson reports doctors are issuing warnings about injuries from frostbite and ice.
For some, this blast of cold is fun, especially for kids who live in states where it rarely snows. Lacey Duff says her kids got to see snow for the first time.
They love it. They think it's great. They've been outside playing in the snow all last night. This one's not too much of a fan. We're used to a lot warmer weather. This is their first time actually in a snowstorm.
For others, the cold is hazardous. Frigid temperatures have been blamed for at least a dozen deaths. Dr. Christopher Sampson with the University of Missouri Healthcare says frostbite is the biggest concern.
With frostbite, people can start experiencing symptoms pretty rapidly. On average, with mild winds and cold temperatures, it can occur in as less as than 30 minutes. With extreme cases, when it's very, very cold and winds are very, very strong, sometimes frostbite can develop in as little as 5 minutes.
Wind chill is also a factor. Gusty winds can make it feel colder, and frostbite can affect more than skin. Dr. Edward Ward at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago says doctors routinely see cases where people underestimate how cold it is outside or how long they'll be outdoors. And that's when frostbite sets in.
When the air temperature drops below zero, especially factoring in wind chill, things freeze. And that includes the fluids that's within your fingers, your toes, nose, ears. You know, anything that's exposed to that wind chill can be affected by frostbite.
Subfreezing temperatures create ice, causing people to slip and fall. Sampson says that's another risk associated with the cold.
That's probably the biggest risk to people, is they think there's no ice and they step on a patch and then slip and injure themselves.
Driving through high winds, low temperatures, fog, rain, and heavy snow is hazardous. Sometimes the wind can blow over vehicles, and there are a lot more accidents in winter than in summer. The Federal Highway Administration says 22% of U.S. vehicle accidents are weather-related. People are being asked to stay off the roads so plows and salt trucks can get through. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. The Golden Globes was a sea of black on the red carpet Sunday night as women attending wore the color in solidarity with the advocacy group Time's Up, an ambitious initiative to fight systemic sexual harassment in Hollywood and in workplaces nationwide. The televised award show is the first since Hollywood was hit by multiple sexual harassment scandals this past year. Starting with October's story in the New York Times, detailing decades of alleged harassment and abuse at the hands of then-powerful producer Harvey Weinstein. Actress, producer, and television personality Oprah Winfrey gave an electrifying speech when she accepted the Cecil B. DeMille Award for Lifetime Achievement. Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri was named the best drama, and Lady Bird won for top comedy. Actor Gary Oldman was named best actor for his role as Winston Churchill in the World War II drama Darkest Hour. Did you know that the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which gives out the Golden Globe Awards, also donates millions to charity? VOA's David Byrd tells us how the HFPA is helping bring some joy to children at a Los Angeles hospital.
There aren't any gowns by Versace or shoes by Christiane Louboutin at this opening, but there are plenty of smiles. They belong to the children at the Children's Hospital of Orange County because it's movie day. There's popcorn, candy, and even frozen yogurt. And there's a screening of the animated adventure comedy Ferdinand. The screenings are possible because of charitable donations from the Hollywood Foreign Press Association to the Lollipop Theater Network, which brings first-run films and other entertainment events to children's hospitals across the country. Layla Ayad works for Lollipop.
We've had a partnership with the Hollywood Foreign Press Association for many, many years. They've funded so much of our movie screenings here, especially in the Los Angeles area. And for a nonprofit, the funding that you get from organizations like HFPA is vital. You don't get to do what you do without people helping fund that.
The HFPA has sponsored 180 Lollipop Theater screenings in Southern California, including the recent showing of Ferdinand at Children's Hospital of Orange County. Patients, their siblings, and their parents are invited to watch the film in the hospital's dedicated theater, and it's complete with snacks. But for those who can't leave their rooms, Leila Ayad says the HFPA has provided DVDs so they too can see the film.
They give us several copies of the movie so that we can screen it both in screening rooms and in isolation rooms in other parts of the hospital. And occasionally they also send along fun goodies and movie swag.
Are you trying to steal my stuff?
Oh no, we'd never do something like that.
Nope, not us.
You have offended us, sir.
I'm sorry, little guys. I feel terrible.
Don't fall for it, Fern. They're filthy weasels.
Amber Chavez is the special programs coordinator at Children's Hospital of Orange County.
You know, it's really hard for families, and just families and patients, siblings, the whole family is affected when the patient is here. And so being able to bring this movie here, like movies out, it just breaks up the environment of the hospital and brings normalcy to them.
The Hollywood Foreign Press Association has given almost $30 million to date, including a $2.8 million grant presented at a star-studded banquet in August of last year. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Thanks very much, David. That is our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. We have lots of information there about all kinds of stories in the news, including the just last night's Golden Globe Awards. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, has sanctioned two individuals in response to North Korea's ongoing development of weapons of mass destruction and their means of delivery, in continued violation of United Nations Security Council resolutions. The sanctions, announced on December 26th, target key leaders of North Korea's unlawful weapons programs, as highlighted in the recently adopted UN Security Council Resolution 2397. As a result of these actions, any property or interests in property of those designated by OFAC within U.S. jurisdiction are blocked, and transactions by U.S. persons involving the designated persons are generally prohibited. OFAC sanctioned two individuals pursuant to Executive Order 13687, which targets, among others, officials of the government of North Korea and the Workers' Party of Korea, known as the WPK. OFAC sanctioned two senior officials of the UN and U.S.-designated WPK Munitions Industry Department, Kim Jong-sik and Ri Pyong-chol, who were listed in UN Security Council Resolution 2397. The Munitions Industry Department is responsible for overseeing North Korea's ballistic missile programs and was sanctioned by the U.S. Department of State in 2010, pursuant to Executive Order 13382. Kim Jong-sik reportedly is a key figure in North Korea's ballistic missile development, in particular efforts to switch from liquid to solid-fueled systems, and Ri Pyong-chol is reported to be a key official involved in North Korea's intercontinental ballistic missile development. Treasury is targeting leaders of North Korea's ballistic missile programs as part of our maximum pressure campaign to isolate the DPRK and achieve a fully denuclearized Korean peninsula, said Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. These actions follow United Nations Security Council Resolution 2397, which imposed strong new sanctions on North Korea, further shutting down its ability to raise illicit funds.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.